Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. I am Ryan Lutens, diehard horror fanboy and all-around Academy Awards snob.
I'm Jay Hoffman, master of the dad joke and interpretive dance.
And I'm Erin McCabe, the peacebringer and insightful mama hen of the show.
Here on Flashbacks, we like to get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that have shaped the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives.
So strap on your fanny packs.
Hold on to your butt.
And let's get ready to flashback. If you've ever tried to move through the ranks of your job by teaming up with a cannibalistic psychiatrist to stop a moth-loving mumble mouth that wants to wear a woman's skin as a suit while dancing around to Goodbye Horses, then you may be thinking about Silence of the Lambs. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. We are here to celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Silence of the Lambs. And what better group to do it with than my crazy shenanigans that are my hosts, Jay and Erin. Jay, how's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. I've been having nice dreams since I watched this movie last night.
That's good. That's good.
Sleeping peacefully.
Awesome. Erin, how's it going with you?
I don't know what's a bigger unsettling feeling, watching Silence of the Lambs alone in the house by yourself, or waking up this morning and realizing you've got ants. So that's what I'm dealing with right now.
I don't know. Ants sounds pretty tough to me.
They're everywhere, man.
They're in my raccoon wounds.
The worst. Just the worst. Guy.
And we have an awesome special guest with us tonight, our own host of classics, Mr. Brandon Davis. How are you doing?
I am not bad at all. How are you guys?
We're good. We're good. We're ready to talk this classic.
Yeah. Modern classic.
This was a movie that won the big five, but we're going to hop into all that when we get to our fun facts. So, Jay, give us the rundown.
All right. Clarice Starling is a new FBI recruit seeking to fast track through the ranks by having verbal chess matches with Dr. Hannibal Lecter. This will-they-won't-they tale between a small-town West Virginian lawwoman and an elitist psychiatrist is the ultimate opposites attract love story. The two bond over trying to stop a man on a mission to wear the ultimate makeover suit that he thinks will change his life forever. Will they stop this man from making the ultimate fashion faux pas? Will these two opposites end up together? Do we get the happily ever after suburban dream with kids, a picket fence, and friends for dinner every night? Only time will tell. I think that's accurate.
Thank you, Jay. Thank you, Jay, for that awesome rundown. You write the best rundowns, I swear to God. They shouldn't play across the whole network. No, I can't. I don't want you to do anything else.
They need to. I'm still waiting on that pay bump. So
right. All right, let's talk about the little movie that could, because I think this movie came out of left field, if I remember correctly. I know that the book was written, but let's just hear the fun facts from Erin.
Fun facts. This movie
that was the lamest fun fact ever.
I thought we have a recording now.
Did we?
Oh, no, it's no good.
it's that bad?
It'll work for me later, you know, like if I need something from you. I've got like all this evidence.
Okay, then it is fun facts.
Thank you. Thank fun you. Facts. I am now complete.
All right. So this movie was directed by Jonathan Demme. Is that how I pronounce it?
Demme.
Demme. Okay. I was worried I got that wrong. written by Thomas Harris, who wrote the novel, which the novels are a series. Is that correct? It's a series regarding Hannibal Lecter as the antagonist. And then the screenplay was written by Ted Talley. This film stars Jodie Foster, cast as Clarice Starling, Anthony Hopkins as Dr. Hannibal Lecter, Ted Levine as Jamie Gumm, Scott Glenn as Jack Crawford, Anthony Heald as Dr. Frederick Chilton, Frankie Faison as Barney, and Roger Corman as FBI Director Hayden Burke. So I was surprised to find out that, well, I found out that apparently a couple of actresses have turned down this role, that Demi wanted to give it to Laura Dern, Michelle Pfeiffer. There was someone else in there too, and they all thought that the movie was too gory.
Too violent.
Too lewd, too violent. So I thought that was fascinating. And also I hadn't realized that when Anthony Hopkins, they thought about casting Sean Connery in this role, but he's another one that turned it down and was like, nah, I can't. He's okay with Highlander, not this though.
Ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Come give me a kiss, Clarice.
Wow, that's a real different movie we get there.
Well, that's our show tonight. Thanks.
Hope you enjoyed. But that Anthony Hopkins was considered a lesser known actor.
Yeah.
Morons.
I had no idea.
He just didn't have like the big name like he does now. That's all.
No, after he did this, he went on to Howard's End and Remains the Day and became the classical actor. I mean, he was a Shakespearean guy before this, so.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is I had no clue Roger Corman, the Roger Corman, king of the B movies, in this movie.
He is.
And I think that's hilarious.
I remember like my third or fourth time watching, I was like, oh shit, that's Roger Corman.
I wouldn't have known. I never no knew. Looked like till I was looking at IMDb. I was like, whoa. And then Frankie Faison's on, what is he? He's an alien, isn't it? Isn't an alien? I think he's an alien.
I think maybe.
No, that's, oh man. No, I think you're right. No, it's,
Well, thank you, Hard. We should probably keep going.
Yeah, let's keep going. I'll find the name.
So this film had a budget of $19 million, and opening weekend in the United States grossed $13.7 million. It grossed cumulatively in the United States $130.7 million, and worldwide ended up grossing a cumulative $272.7 million. So this was an international success. That's kind of hard to see, buddy.
It's Yapik Kato was in Alien.
Ah. Okay. Well, thanks for clearing that up. This film has a Rotten Tomatoes score of 96% and Rotten Tomatoes audience score of 95%. As far as awards go, was this the last movie to get the big five?
Last of three.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And have three of us been on a podcast talking about this and Cuckoo's Nest this year?
That's right. Yeah. That's and awesome. the first one was It Happened One Night in 1934. So you've got 30s, 70s, 90s. I will probably put it on the schedule for next year, I'm thinking.
I love me some of that movie.
That's a great movie.
So 30s, 70s, 90s.
And it hasn't been done since.
Makes it the big five? Like, it's just because it's the two lead actors, a screenplay, picture director, like the main...
It's really what people probably consider like the main components, the director, the writer, and the actors. And then, of course, the picture is the amalgamation.
Okay.
I don't know if that's ever going to happen again.
You never know. It could.
Oh, get out of here. Now they're like, share the wealth. Everybody, you want an award? You're getting an award. Did you deserve it last year? You're definitely getting it this year.
Totally. That's exactly what I mean.
Well, and
your performance sucked this year? Getting one anyways.
And 91 is a crazy year at the Oscars because you've got this movie, you've got Beauty and the Beast and JFK and The Prince of Tides and Bugsy. Those were the five Best Picture nominees. So.
Oh, Nick Nolte can take a long walk.
Bugsy, and that's starring Warren Beatty.
That's Warren Beatty.
Yeah, so God knows he campaigned to the heavens to try to.
Now I can see why a horror movie won.
He admits it's a horror movie.
There we go. So
I always have.
Oh, this is going to be fun,
but
later.
It's more psychological thriller. All right, let's get through fun facts.
So this film was nominated for the Academy Awards Best Sound, Best Film Editing, Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Anthony Hopkins, Best Actress, Jodie Foster, Best Adapted Screenplay, Ted Talley. It wins Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Adapted Screenplay to round out the big five. For Golden Globes, it was nominated for Best Movie, Best Director, Best Actor, and Best Screenplay. However, it only won Best Actress for Jodie Foster. The Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Film nominated this film much of the same awards, Best Actress, Best Director, Best Music, though, and Best Costumes. It won Best Horror Film.
Wait, it wasn't Best Thriller Film? Best Horror Film.
I believe it's from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and or Horror, so of course it's going to win Best Horror.
Oh, yeah, they didn't even throw a thriller in there because it just falls under horror. Got it.
This is the new Nomadland. This is the new argument between Jay
and Ron. Subgenres are important.
We will find the most smallest thing and argue about it.
Welcome, Brandon. Welcome to my life. So, Best Horror Film won Best Horror Film from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror. Best Actor, Best Writing, and Best Makeup. It also won awards for the Fangoria Chainsaw Awards. Nominated for Best Soundtrack, it won Best Actress, Best Actor, Best Screenplay, and Best Studio/Big Budget Film.
Now, Fangoria, that's like a horror magazine, right?
They dabble in all types of horror, including psychological thrillers. I think they really like Seven, which is another psychological thriller.
We are going to have a podcast just on psychological thrillers. For sure. So this film is rated number 65 out of 100 movies for AFI's 100 years. It's AFI's, for their 10th anniversary, it was ranked 74. For AFI's 100 years, 100 thrills, it's ranked number 5.
Can you say that again? 100 what? Thrills. Thank you.
It's not 100 thrillers. It's 100 thrills.
Thrills is the root word of thrillers. Thank you. Number 5.
AFI's 100 years, 100 heroes and villains. Clarice Starling is ranked number 6 as a hero. Hannibal Lecter as the number 1 villain. Buffalo Bill is a nominated villain. I think he should be in there somewhere.
Underrated. I think he gets overshadowed. But I think
it's a joy to be nominated.
Yeah, that's true. And AFI's 100 years, 100 movie quotes, number 1. Ryan?
That's 21.
I'm sorry, 21.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
So good.
He took a lot of pleasure. You can't see his eyes through this podcast, but he took a lot of pleasure in doing that.
My favorite lines ever.
I gave it to him. I knew he'd have fun. So here's some more fun facts. With only 24 minutes and 52 seconds of screen time, Sir Anthony Hopkins' performance in this movie is the second shortest to ever win an Academy Award for Best Actor in a Leading Role. With David Niven in Separate Tables, which was a 1958 film, beating him at 23 minutes and 39 seconds. Director Jonathan Demme thought that casting a megastar like Robert De Niro or Jack Nicholson would have focused that audience's attention on the actor's performance rather than on the story. So he cast the lesser known, quote unquote, Anthony Hopkins. So wild to me.
Yeah, it's really bizarre 30 years later because he's like huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is like really... I think he was a known actor, but he wasn't like a megastar.
He probably would have been like a household name to British audiences, but here in the States, I don't think you probably would have recognized his face, but not his name.
Besides,
now he's in Transformers.
Elephant Man. What else? What else? Like big movies that a lot of people had seen.
One of his very first movies, he plays Katharine Hepburn's son in The Lion in Winter when he was in like his 20s or 30s. And so he'd done little parts like that.
He was in a horror movie in the 70s with a dummy called Magic.
Oh. I will check that out.
Neat.
Thanks for that movie information. I'm going to keep reading now.
I was lost in thought thinking about it's a lot easier to be more in the know about British media with streaming platforms. Like the only reason everyone knows now I'm blanking on her name, so I sound like a clown. Coleman. Why am I blanking on her first name?
Olivia
Coleman. The reason people in the United States know Olivia Coleman is not because they spent their time watching Broadchurch. It's because they spent their time watching The Crown, and they know her through that. And there, I think, are a couple other people who are definitely well-known in the, like you're saying, Brandon, in the film circuit, that the only reason people know them now is because of how accessible the media is.
Right.
I thought we knew all 25 British actors and actresses because of Harry Potter.
Harry Potter and Downton Abbey.
I'm convinced there's only 25 British actors and actresses on film.
You know, that's so funny about Downton Abbey too. Well, you're kind of right. That's so funny about Downton Abbey too, because that wasn't originally on a streaming platform. People were like flocking to PBS.
PBS.
Mm-hmm. To watch that. You know, so yep. That's what I was doing to watch Sherlock, if I'm being honest. Because I love me some Benedict Cumberbatch. all right, onward.
Control yourself.
Gene Hackman, this is really interesting. Gene Hackman bought the rights to the novel. He planned to direct this movie and play either Dr. Hannibal Lecter or Jack Crawford, but he withdrew after watching a clip of himself in Mississippi Burning, which was a 1988 film, mm-hmm. at the 61st Academy Awards in 89. So it made him too uneasy about taking more violent roles.
How could the coach from Hoosiers be Hannibal Lecter?
You know? Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Even when he's a bad guy, he's not, I don't know.
He's not that bad.
I've seen Unforgiven.
Yeah, he's like a one. He's good in it, but he's just like, yeah. Just like a dick. Like he's right. not crazy right. evil.
Not villainy.
Yeah, no, not like this level. And then, so Sir Anthony Hopkins described his voice for Hannibal Lecter as a combination of Truman Capote and Katharine Hepburn.
I can see it.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for those fun facts. You know, I was sitting here thinking, I'm like, yeah, we do kind of go long sometimes. And I think this is where a lot of it comes in. But this is fun. I think our banter.
So much had to be cut. Fun.
Yeah, right.
There are even more facts in this.
Huge, and of course, we'll get to that when we talk impact. But it looks like my internet's not working.
You're working.
Okay,
keep going.
Okay. First memory of the film, Brendan. You're our guest. What is your first memory when it comes to your first viewing of Silence of the Lambs?
My first viewing of this movie was in college. Jeremy and I have said on this podcast many times that over a summer when he was here and he and I were in here in Lincoln together at the same time, we watched all 100 of the top 100 movie lists. And that was the first time I saw it. So I was probably early 20s. I came to it kind of late because this typically isn't my genre that I kick back and watch. But this movie grabbed me just because of the how artistically it's done and because of the performances. So it was one of the ones that kind of pleasantly surprised me as we were going down the list. It's a fascinating movie.
What genre would this be?
Thriller. Aaron, what
no,
are your...
I like thrillers. Horror usually isn't my genre, is what I was saying. I'm sorry.
Oh!
Trying to coax Brandon inside.
I'm not going to say anything. Aaron, you're up. What are your first memories?
You guys were all like 4 when I watched this movie. Brandon, you definitely were, probably. So this movie came out. I remember it as a kid, again, too young to be watching crap like this, but we had cable and HBO, and I specifically remember, I'm sure it was a couple years later, so what, 91? I bet I was about 11. And it was on, and it was one of those things that, I knew I wasn't supposed to be watching it, so I, was snuck away and, hiding and trying to watch it, and then also being, completely disturbed. But I never saw the whole thing. I saw it in pieces, and it really, I don't even remember the last time I saw it all the way through, so... The most recent viewing that I did today was sitting down, my kids were out of the house, I'm on vacation and watching it with my cats. And it is so unsettling. So unsettling. I don't know. I just remember growing up and always all of the references, obviously, you couldn't escape Hannibal Lecter references and Silence of the Lamb references and stuff like that. So I don't know. It's always kind of been in my cultural zeitgeist ever since I was in, for me, I was in grammar school, elementary school, junior high.
The hell's grammar school?
Right. Must be a term from the 80s. All right, Jay, what are your first memories?
Across the tracks. We went to grammar schools.
Train tracks again. Jay, you're up.
Very much the same. I grew up in a horror household, so horror was always on. I don't remember watching the whole thing, but I definitely remember bits and pieces of this movie when I was probably way too young to be watching it. First time really watching it would have been sometime in junior high, and then definitely repeated viewings in high school. It's not the first time. I very specifically remember because, I was a super cool guy in high school. So one of my buddies was having a video game party at his house. And then late at night, we put on this movie, man. And this is a movie for me, too. So I always talk about, I got this giant rotating list. This is on my list of 20 movies that randomly falls into my favorite movie list. I absolutely love this movie. This is an annual viewing for me for the most part, around the Halloween time frame. Although anymore, I kind of try to watch newer horror stuff, but it's one of my regulars. And I love this movie. I think for me, why I love it so much too, and why it sticks with me so much, is how grounded it is. It feels very much like it could be real. It's such a procedural, it's such a procedural. So I won't get into that till we get into takeaways and stuff. But definitely middle school is where I remember for the first time probably watching it from beginning to end. And then, like I said, it's been in my wheelhouse since then.
Yeah, I'm with Jay. I mean, me and Jay both have a proclivity for horror and the subgenre of psychological thrillers. He almost did a spit take there, folks. No, I just remember I remember seeing it on TV. I don't know how young I was, and I was 5 in 91, Aaron. So,
yeah, when you were getting your driver's license or whatever.
Yeah, kind of babysitting. I could have babysat.
But I remember seeing bits and pieces off TV. I don't think I ever sat through it until I was in high school. But I remember I was sitting watching it with my mother, and it was playing, and it was during his escape, and he's yeah. in the ambulance, and it cuts away during the good part. Uh-huh. And I'm like, what just happened? And my mom's like, I'm like, hey.
That was very insightful as you cut out everything you just said.
Sweet. This is my reminder that Tom sucks and it is not good internet.
It's like your mom was Charlie Brown's teacher.
Right. Anyway, I was watching it on TV and having things cut off or cut in and out. And my mother would be like, you know, the scene where he escapes. And I was like, what happened? She's like, oh, it's gory. They can't show it. You know, but I remember watching it in high school. And the class that won Best Picture. Is it doing it again?
I feel like it's your mom. Like, she still wants you to not talk about it.
Right. Clearly.
She's like, no, Ryan, it's still too not. It's no, I don't. It's, I don't
it's,
want
it's
my.
Too, it's still too gory. It's too gory.
Yeah.
I'm going to be done talking. I just remember watching it in high school for the first time and falling in love with it. And it is, like Jay, it's one of my go-to. And, you know, with the revival of the Hannibal TV show, which we'll talk about later, it really renewed that love for the movie. But now let's talk about this. These are just things about the movie. I'm sure there's going to be a laundry list here. So let's just dive into it. Aaron, let's start with you.
Acting?
Go for it. Talk about the movie.
Oh my gosh. I mean, what's there not to say? Like, you understand why Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster took home the Oscars that year, hands down. Their performances were incredible. I love watching it this time. All the way through, and as like a 38-year-old woman, watching Jodie Foster's performance and just the way that her character was crafted. I read some criticisms of this film. You know, there's plenty of crap that people talk about this film for varying reasons. But one of the criticisms that I read about this film was from some feminist groups saying that, like, this was back in, you know, I don't know about now, but when it came out, you know, they thought that this movie was really, really offensive because it's clearly about a man who's murdering and torturing women. However, when I watched it and I saw what an incredibly strong female character Clarice Starling is, I was like, I guess I see where they're coming from in the sense that they're upset about the treatment of women, but like, I don't think this is one of the strongest female leads in cinema. Clarice Starling is a complete badass. She's like the feminist. She's built as a character and through the story that constantly has to fight for her own way in a male-led field, and she does it the whole time by not, you know, relying on her feminine wiles. Like, she does it with her skill and with merit, and, you know, is doing everything procedurally and by the book and with respect and integrity, and she's awesome. So I loved watching this, and while I was watching it, I just couldn't help but be like, I mean, feminists shouldn't be complaining about this film. They should be looking at her and being like, oh my God, like in the 90s, You know, I feel like Demi went out of his way to show all of the ways that Clarice had to go up against men in order to, I don't know, prove herself.
Well, and on top of that, it makes it sound like we're supposed to side with Buffalo Bill. Like, at no point in time we're like, this guy's got it going on. Like, at no point are we on his side. He's a total creepo, and it makes it sound like this is terrible. They're glorifying. They're not glorifying at all.
Oh, none of it was horrific.
And then, like you said, then in the end, who's he stopped by? Right. So, and then there's some of the other complaints. I know you're like, I don't know if we should go there. We should totally go there. Okay. Some of the other complaints that I've seen out there that they think it's there's homophobic undertones, transphobic undertones to the movie. And I guess I would say I could see where people interpret that, but I think it's misguided, right? Because they say there's undertones that either Clarice is gay and hiding it. I've read that one, which I didn't get that either. Well, yeah, and it's like, is it because she didn't use her femininity with the men? I don't know.
I think that more has to do with them bringing real life Jodie Foster onto the role. I think she got a lot of criticism back then because everybody figured she was secretly closeted, and so everybody put that onto the character of Clarice. I think it was real life playing into the role.
And then the transphobic stuff, right? Like I said, I could see how you interpret it, but there's a line where Hannibal's like, He's not that. He thinks he is. He's just a wildly confused. Confused is an understatement, right? This guy, his motivation is to skin women and make a skin suit to wear. Like, no part of this guy, right? This guy has all sorts of issues going on. And he said straight up that, you know, that's not what he is. He thinks, right? And the whole thing with the moths. Moths go into a cocoon. They come out transformed, different.
Yeah.
It's not that he's trying to live the identity that he feels. It's that he's trying to transform from what he is into something else.
Right.
So
on the flip side of that,
to escape some sort of trauma he dealt with as a child that he was created. This, and Clarice kind of goes into, or, you know, saying that, like, they use the word transsexual, but like saying,
They use some dated terminology. They say transvestite and transsexual.
Gender dysphoria didn't exist. The DSM-4 was much more narrow in terms of, I mean, I think all you had was gender identity disorder. Like, it was, very dated. But, like, she goes up, like, I don't think it's a movie that portrays transphobia.
I want to go back to Jay's point about the whole moth. I mean, think about the transformation process. You know, in James Gunn's Buffalo's Troubled Mind, that if he can build a suit, he can come out transformed. I mean, that is one way to look at it. I mean, I get where they're coming. If you think about it in terms of what they're doing with the plot, that's essentially what he's doing in the movie. He is making his cocoon.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So I don't, like I said, I understand people coming to that, but I don't think they're given a full view of the storyline. I think they're oversimplifying it and saying this guy's doing bad things and he's trans, or I guess it would be she's trans, even though explicitly it's stated the opposite of that. You know, in the movie by Hannibal Lecter. So I did want to address that just because that there is that argument out there, and I still, once again, understand it, but I disagree with it.
Yeah. That's
go ahead.
No, and I was going to say, as far as Clarice being a lesbian because she won't climb the ranks by, you know, they allude to that. Jonathan Demme alludes to that. And Ted Talley in the screenplay that, like, you know, her, what's his name? I keep wanting to say Calhoun, but it's Crawford.
Hilton.
Yeah,
Crawford.
Crawford.
Hilton, Crawford, they all kind of do this like, hey, you know, Clarice, and kind of, you know, kind of give her bait to see if she'll bite. And she doesn't. She keeps it professional the whole time. And then, you know, it's kind of at the end of the movie comes to fruition where Crawford, you know, they shake hands and there's a mutual respect there. They're on the same level. That was what I interpreted. And I think, but that's also, you know, me growing up in the 90s and as a younger girl, I caddied. I saw women leverage. I saw girls leverage sexual attention in ways to advance rank. And I remember being like, nah, like I took the Clarice route. Like I was like, nah, that's not going to be me. I'm going to be straight and narrow and I'm going to get, you know, I'm going to do a good job and you're going to think I do a good job because I actually do a good job, not because you think I'm a piece of ass kind of thing, you know? So I don't know. That's how I resonated with it.
Ryan.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I do think Jack Crawford, I think he had a mutual respect for her, but mm-hmm. I also think he wasn't one to hesitate to utilize his position of rank to accomplish whatever he wanted. Like there's the scene at the funeral where there's all the male police officers and he tells the sheriff, you know, I truly think when he told Clarice, hey, you know, I really wasn't worried about you being in there. It was just me trying to just get those guys to go along with what I needed. And so It doesn't really matter. And she goes, no, it does matter because it matters. They were following your lead. And you know what? He goes, you know what? Point taken. You know, and I think that was genuine. Like I thought all those interactions were genuine. I don't think any of his stuff was ever from a sexist point of view, but from a, this is my mission that I need to accomplish and I'll do whatever it takes, including sending a young cadet in to talk with, you know, the psycho genius serial. Like he would do whatever it takes to accomplish the mission. So I think he's one who would leverage power, but not with any sort of sexist intentions.
Mm, yeah.
So we're acting. Let's talk Scott Glenn. What do you guys think about his performance?
He's great. Of the Jack Crawfords that I've seen, I like him the best. He did follow around the gosh, I can't remember the guy's real name. It's the guy in Mindhunters on Netflix. That's who his character is based off of. He followed the real life guy around to train for his character. And that's I thought he was really good. He's very matter of fact and a lot different than say like the version we got from Lawrence Fishburne and then God, I can't remember the guy's name from Manhunter, but totally different version from that one too. I really liked him in this movie.
Yeah, I think this movie, you know, yes, it got the big five, but it the movie's on bulls, and I think it's because it's a great cast. You know, Anthony Held as Frederick Chill just oozes the type of, you know, villain that, you know, Clarice would have, you know, the complete opposite of, you know, you got Bazan as, you got, you may work better with my camera off. Okay.
It looks better.
Teen as Game Gum. I mean, this cast is just stacked. It works because you've got so many people that are doing what they need to do and being believable. It makes this movie just mesh so well. Does anybody else have anything about acting before we want to Brandon? What his? No. What's another?
I think he said Brandon, and Brandon wasn't sure because you cut out.
Oh.
This is my favorite part of these.
I heard my name, but I didn't hear what I was asked.
I think it was anything on acting.
Anything on acting? Okay. No, well, I just wanted to go off what Aaron was saying. There's a reason why Clarice Starling is the highest ranking female on the Greatest Heroes list, because she's every person. She, I just, Jodie Foster is one of those actresses that I love to watch think, because she keeps it, she knows how to be still in the moment and still make it compelling. And she never ever lets her emotions get the best of her when she knows all these men around her are waiting for her to do that. You know, whether it be on the police force or whether it be, you know, one of these, you know, unseemly villains that she's working with, but she's unflappable, and I love to watch that. And she's so heroic at what she does. You know, whether she's just going step by step through the procedural, you know, and of course at the end, which I'm sure that we'll get to. But Anthony Hopkins, I mean, you mentioned it. It's a 24 minute performance, and you know, I guess technically he should have been nominated for supporting actor, but you can't think about this movie without thinking about him, because his presence is throughout the whole thing. And it is such a unique performance. I don't think audiences had ever seen such a, like a demonic kind of villain who presented himself in that very elegant, classy way that was just so unsettling, because you're like, this isn't just a guy that you can, you know, trick around. You know, this is a guy that is always going to be one step ahead of you. And the thing about Lecter for me is always, he was never appreciated for his heroic aspects, so he had to embrace his evil aspects. So he had to let those overshadow, you know, all the good he tried to do as a psychologist. And so he just, you know, went to that side, and that's the way that he was able to sort of be noticed. You know, that was sort of his transformation, like we've been talking about.
Right.
Yeah. He's a terrifying character.
Yeah.
Like when they make the statement that of, when Chilton shows Clarice the picture of what he did to the nurse who got too close, and then makes the statement, and his heart rate never got above 85. And you see that look of calmness on him as he does the other horrific acts through the movie. It is a chilling performance.
And just the mind games that he plays. And it's almost like when Demi gets that camera right up to his face and he's staring right at you, it's like he's staring into your soul. And you're right. Like, hey, this guy's playing mind games with me as the audience, because I'm actually kind of liking this guy, you know, for just a little bit, because he is charming in his own, you know, very elegant, you know, whatever, you know, Hepburn accent he's using. but yeah, I mean, talk about, you know, perfect casting. I mean, the Hopkins, no matter what he plays, is going to be married to this role forever, because he just defined a different kind of villain that we hadn't seen before.
Yeah.
There's a lot of physicality with how he carries himself, but his eyes, you know, he doesn't blink on camera. Very intentionally doesn't blink. He does these things where he'll like just stare into the camera, like you said, staring at Clarice, and then he'll just slowly look at whatever the thing is you're supposed to look at. And it's just like it's a weird way that he carries himself. But I read that Demi tried to film, every time he tried to film Hannibal, he wanted you to think that Hannibal knew every single thing that was happening at all points in time.
Yeah. Yeah,
and succeeded
well. And the very first scene where she is going down to his cell, and you know, she's walking past all of the other creepy prisoners, and the minute she walks past and you see him, and it's almost like he saw her coming before she even saw him, and because he's staring right, you know, into her, and it's almost like he can look through walls. Mm-hmm. And that's how scary he is, because he is literally on top of everything that is happening.
A guy choke on his tongue. Sorry, Ryan.
Yeah.
That's another thing. And again, if I cut, just let me know, because then I'll stop talking. But whenever you see him, he's always straight. I mean, he's just very, how could this guy, he holds him hard, but no, like you turn your back, you're just like the
little
perfect
rough,
casting.
Buddy.
Sorry. I'm done.
We'll call you Apache. But I think what you're saying is just how his posture and the way his chest, he looks like Anthony Hopkins. I don't think he's very big, but he looks like barrel chested in this, like just the way his posture was, and it made him look more physically intimidating than I think he probably is. And I think that was pretty
cool. He almost looks like just jacked and swole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he does.
Let's talk about, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you know, as a young nursing student, you know, in nursing school, I don't know what it's like now, but you had to go through psychiatric rotations and sometimes prison rotations. So there were aspects of this film that like brought me back to that, where like being on like the lockdown psych unit, which could be very intense, or in a prison. And, you know, there is definitely something about the power dynamic of when someone comes on to a scene like that, that people view as vulnerable, or, you know, that they kind of want to mess with you more. And so that was like very much resonated with me, having her step into as a young cadet, you know, and she's like, I know everything, I'm so tough. And walking into those scenarios and like, you're just not actually like, you're not ready for it. Like, I remember people, and of course they're not trying to put you in harm's way, but like, I remember very aggressive patients coming up to me in very aggressive ways, very close, saying inappropriate things. They want to rise out of you. It's a very strange experience, especially as a young woman, you know? So this movie even hit harder, having experienced some of that myself. And I don't know.
Yeah, I think it would be more intense. Like, my guard unit was the backup when I was in the service, was the backup if there was like a crazy prison break, you know? So we would go randomly take tours, and even like a group of soldiers, they're like trying to shout stuff, and you're like, really, really, yeah, guy, you know? But so I can imagine being one or just a few, and only being women, it could be intense. But I was wondering if we could talk about Ted Levine, because I think his performance is super stellar, especially if you watch anything else he's in, which is funny because he's like, seems like he's a cop a lot after this. But I think his performance is unfortunately overshadowed, because I really do think we have two great antagonists, depending on how you look at Hannibal, because I think Buffalo Bill is also absolutely frightening, and he feels like a fully formed character. And it was a 100%, you know, it's part based on Ed Gein, you know, who was a serial killer who used body parts to make furniture. It's part based on Ted Bundy, who would pretend he had a broken arm to lure women and bash them with the cast, you know. So it's based off of a plethora of actual serial killers, which is why I think he doesn't ever feel to me cartoonish. Right. He seems real. He seems clearly off his rocker, but he seems like a real person, and he can turn things on and turn them off when he answers the door, when he talks to people, when he was pretending to load the couch. So I think that's another really great performance in this that just unfortunately falls under the shadow of Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, he's a much more sadistic version of Norman Bates. I feel like he's kind of that next, you know, he's kind of like, and Norman Bates was based off of Ed Gein as well. So it's kind of like how Norman Bates would be if he didn't have Mother talking to him all the time, I feel like. Yeah. But yeah, he's terrifying. He's the one, you know, it's almost like I would take my chances with Lecter, but he's the Buffalo Bill's the one I wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley.
Yeah.
Hannibal Lecter is more composed. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say, like, even Clarice was like, no, he wouldn't do that. That would be considered, you know, like,
he
not
has, he has principles, but however weird that is to say,
he doesn't want to do anything rude. That's what
Yeah, no, he definitely is principled, whereas Buffalo Bill is a wild card because of, you know, again, coming back to his traumatic issues and him feeling probably so uncomfortable in his own skin and in his own body. And I do think there is something that I think Buffalo Bill also gets overshadowed by the one scene, yeah. You know, where he does the talk and then everyone kind of like talks about that. So I can understand maybe from like the transgender community where if that ends up being the like big thing that everyone looks at and they're like, ah, you made it transphobic, you know, because he is, I agree with you, Jay, he's a well-rounded character and he is well thought out, but you've got to, you know, if you're watching it in high school and that in the 90s and that's all you see, that's out in your head, you know.
Yeah, dumb high school kids.
Right, exactly. Even high school kids now who watch that would see it in a very different, you know, light. But no, he's a very, very, he's a complex character that I agree does deserve more accolades than just, you know, that scene in the one line, it puts the lotion on its skin, you know?
Well, he's got two, then the other line.
He's putting the lipstick on. Like, that's all he's really, like, known for.
Well, and that dance scene, too, I read Ted Levine requested that scene because it wasn't written, but it was in the book. Sorry, Ryan, what were you saying?
No, I said that was the
yep.
Is it breaking up still? Like, do I have to bow out? All right. Okay. I'm going to bow out. I love my flashback crew. But talk about this. I love the story. That's all I got to say.
All right. We'll bring it home for you, buddy. That darn internet. I know he was looking forward to talking this one, too.
Yeah.
Sorry, man. All right. Any other acting? I mean, I think we kind of got the big players in that. So aside from some of the acting, what would some of the other takeaways, other standouts from this movie be for you? We'll start with you, Brandon.
Just, you know, we kind of mentioned a lot the visuals. I think Demme really goes for like a Hitchcockian style in this movie where he does interesting things with the camera. Like we talked about, you know, Jodie Foster and Anthony Hopkins are not really talking to each other. They're, you know, talking into the camera. And I saw an interview with Jodie Foster where she said, you know, a lot of times her and Hopkins weren't connecting with each other as actors because they would be feeding each other the lines, but you would just be staring directly into the camera. And so it was almost like, you know, playing to, you know, yourself in a vacuum. But he does that sort of thing. And it's, you know, it's all these sort of, you know, people who don't feel comfortable in their own skin kind of during certain times in the movie. But yeah, there's just visuals in this movie that stick with me, you know, just the visual of Catherine in the well with the dog, you know, and that scene, you know, as we were talking about Buffalo Bill, that's the one scene where he almost seems human because she almost gets to him when, you know, she's calling out to him and he doesn't let himself get to that place where he feels human. And so I think that's, you know, something internal that makes him more of an interesting character.
Yeah. And that part too, where he's starting to get all worried about Precious, then he turns it on. You don't even know what pain is. And you're like, ooh.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, he doesn't cry in that scene where Catherine's crying until she says, I want to see my mommy.
Yeah.
And then he, yeah, it's, I noticed that it's, and then, yeah. Mm.
And talk about, you know, such another pop culture image, you know, Hannibal Lecter and the Mask, you know, when they're rolling him in, you know, that's how at the Oscars that year, Billy Crystal was the host and that was his entrance. They rolled him out
in that
mask and cut to Anthony Hopkins in the audience, you know, laughing. And you know, that's such a great moment. But that scene when he's talking to the senator about Catherine, he's doing, you know, he's so still and he's doing so little, but you only see a little bit of his mouth and his eyes and he's conveying so much and it's terrifying.
It is totally terrifying and completely iconic.
Mm-hmm. Horrifying.
Horrifying. Thrilling and horrifying.
Aaron, what's what?
I'm gonna have to carry Ryan for this.
What's a takeaway for you from this movie?
You know, I was really unsettled, I'm sure intentionally, by the cinematography. They are so close in everyone's face. It's like you're about 1 to 2 feet away from Clarice and Hannibal's face almost at all times. You're following them. It's a very interesting, I don't feel like I've seen a movie where I've felt that uncomfortably close to a character. And I imagine that was completely intentional. Is there another film that does that, even the shot, reverse shot, that close up? I can't think of any. Can you guys? Usually we're panned out more.
Yeah, there is. I don't know if either of you two have seen Marathon Man with Dustin Hoffman, but there are some scenes in that movie where he's in the chair and Gell, played by Olivier, who's the Nazi, and he does that famous line, "Is it safe?" And they pan closer and closer to his face as each cut happens, but not for as long, I don't think, as it is in Silence of the Lambs, though.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's like the entire film. And I feel like that definitely adds to the feeling of tension, but just that unsettled, like you're in their personal space so much that you're not, you have no choice but to like be involved. Like you feel like you're in the middle of them. And when you don't want to be, like where you'd rather be like, I'd kind of like to watch this, like, you know, 6 feet away. I'd like some social distancing here. I'd like some social distancing, and you can't get out of it. You can't get away. But I also really appreciated that.
Yeah. It's like a psychological form of, claustrophobia, you know?
Yeah.
It's not walls. It's just like intense, feelings and emotions and power control squeezing in on you.
And there's nothing outside of the frame. Like, there's nothing in the frame but them. So you can't get out of it unless you break away from, you know, the actual movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I got two takeaways. One is the score. I absolutely love the score. Howard Shore and, Lord of the Rings, man. Love that score too. But this score I really love. Brandon, for the listeners, sent us a clip of Siskel and Ebert arguing about this movie. And one of Siskel's complaints was the score. I mean, like, that was one of my absolute favorite parts. I thought that it brought a gravitas and added to that the scare elements of the movie for me. So I really, really like the score. And I think too, this day and age, scores for the most part don't stand out as much. A lot of them are just like recycled, slightly different versions. There's some great stuff on YouTube about how scores are not like they used to be, because they really just snip stuff from other stuff. So this one really stands out to me. I mentioned the procedural elements, but the procedural elements, man, I just found absolutely captivating, right? Because it's not just, and you say procedural now, you know, and you're just like, oh, like 57 CSIs and 85 Law and Orders. And those are like nice comfort food TV shows that you can like throw on and not have to think too much. But I think those probably have a lot of debt owed to this. I the procedural elements of this, I can't help but think that David Fincher is wildly influenced by this movie. Like, there's no way this isn't a major influence in his filmography. When you look at Seven, you look at Zodiac, you look at Mindhunters, and it's the same thing. He approaches this horror with this procedural element where these folks are doing detective work on this just absolutely horrifying stuff. And yeah. So I really, really like how they did the procedural work in this. And I would say, you know, we say Hannibal and Clarice are the long lasting stuff, but I think that the procedural influence might be, you know, one of its biggest influences from this movie. Yeah.
And you mentioned the Siskel and Ebert review that I sent you all in. Both of the, I mean, even though Ebert liked the movie, he and Siskel share the same criticism of the ending of her, you know, where is he in the house sort of ending. But I think it's unique because we're in on where he is as the audience, because we're looking at it from his point of view. So when he reaches out to touch her, you know, we see it. It's not going to be your typical jump scare for us in the audience like it would be in a normal horror movie. So I think Demi sort of turns that kind of scene on its head.
Yeah, I was like absolutely flabbergasted when they were like, it was just a ho-hum run-of-the-mill horror. And I was like, what? No. He could have blown her brains out at any second, and he didn't.
Yeah, right.
He was like toying with her, and he was finding this enjoyment from being, you know, 2 feet away from her and knowing, you know, like thriving in that power that he was getting. Like, what other movie is like, no man, if it's like that, it's just like slasher movie stuff, you know? And this did not feel like that at all. That was a weird criticism.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had a lot of weird, I mean, he had a lot of weird criticisms of this film, you know, on that too. It was kind of just so funny to hear. But yeah, that's another scene that holds you in a great deal of tension, at least for me. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that like really bothered me in this movie where I find extremely horrifying. you know, like that was like, oh my God, is he going to touch her? She doesn't know, being touched and not being able to see and being that much out of control in the beginning of the movie when she walks down in there with all those prisoners and she's walking back. I mean, that one guy, I'm assuming, please correct me if I'm wrong, but Miggs was pleasuring himself.
Oh,
she gets hit with semen.
Yep.
That is horrifying. That is a nightmare to me. You know, like there are many aspects as a female viewer where this movie is just terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, that scene terrifies me too. No, thank you. let's look at impact. What's the impact? What's the long term, you know, story about Silence? Where is it in the zeitgeist? You know, what do you think, Aaron?
Well, I think you're 100% right. It's like everything that came after this, it's hard to not acknowledge that they've all got some Silence of the Lambs influence on them. I mean, especially with the like super diabolical cat and mouse antagonist, protagonist, like do we get Seven the way we get Seven without this movie, when they push that envelope, you know? This, I feel like, launched a bunch of female cat and mouse detective, like psychological thrillers, like I'm blanking out with Ashley Judd, Kiss the Girls. Kiss the Girls, and then there's one after that, like in the 90s, like that got kind of big. But even still today, I mean, I watch Riverdale on the CW, and there's a huge homage to Silence of the Lambs. Betty in Riverdale is like, she comes kind of from like a family of serial killers. She's in the FBI. She's trying to find a serial killer. Like even in 2021, Clarice Starling is still being represented and respected in pop culture, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think, Brandon?
Well, all the obvious reasons that we've talked about, you know, whether, you know, it was, you know, the Academy, you know, recognizing, you know, kind of a subgenre in that way. But like, I thought about it, you know, it kind of started this new genre of the protagonists using a villain to catch another villain. You know, and most recently, and I hope, you know, and spoilers for anybody who hasn't, but, you know, on Falcon and Winter Soldier, Sam and Bucky are kind of making Zemo their Lecter in this. They're trying to use him to, you know, find a way to the other villains of the piece. And so it kind of started that. I can't think of any other movie before this that even attempted that. So that was kind of a new sort of psychological way that you could tell a story that kind of zigzagged in a way that it hadn't been told before. But, you know, it also just, I think Hannibal Lecter kind of created a new form of villain that wasn't, you know, too over the top, but was a little too, you know, not physically imposing, not physically scary, but psychologically terrifying. And I think we had a whole stream of that in the 90s after Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think Hannibal Lecter became like in the, you know, the gauntlet of like horror movie monster icons. You know, you'll see pictures of like Freddy Krueger and Jason, but like Hannibal Lecter's in all those pictures.
Right.
You know, and it's like, wow, this is the best picture. And they're putting the guy in with like the horror movies we love, you know, here on Flashbacks. But just it's interesting, right? That he created this, you know, very prestige kind of horror monster that fills in with some of those more, you know, goofier Pinhead and Freddy and Jason and all those guys. So I think that's interesting. And he still is up there. But I do think when it comes to, and we'll get into sequel and if we want to rank them or whatever in just a second, but a bit of a diminishing return on anything else that kind of followed this. But do you guys have anything you would have liked to have seen different, you know, on this, Brandon?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, some of it isn't timeless, as we mentioned. Some of it, you know, is stuck in 1991, but you're going to have that for a movie made in 1991. Yeah. So you can't blame it for anything. But I think it's not slow moving at all. I think it's paced very well. I think you get just enough of both Hannibal and Buffalo Bill. You know, I think when you use the antagonist too much on screen, it can become a little overwhelming. So they reveal just enough, and we get, you know, Clarice the rest of the time, and she's the one that we really want to spend most of our time with. But I don't think I would change much of anything about this movie. I think it's a pretty unique sort of psychological horror thriller.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I love this movie. I wouldn't change anything. What do you think, Aaron? Anything you didn't?
Well, okay, this is the only thing I'd offer, since I am such an expert. I was a little taken aback at, this movie is so well done, it's so clean. I thought the practical effects with some of the gore, I just was shocked that like the blood looked more like red paint than... I was like, oh, you guys couldn't. I mean, I get it. It was a prestigious film, but like you couldn't slum it to like the B horror movies in 1991 for like a hot minute just to get some like tips for the blood. Cause like that was the only thing that just seemed mismatched for how clean and well done everything else was in this movie. And I mean, I'm trying to think back to, I don't know, it just kind of looked red paintish to me.
I maybe a counter to that. This was in the day and age where like, you had to be careful with how real you made that stuff, because you could easily veer into, and this movie probably walked a line. You could veer into NC-17 or X, which I mean, are those even ratings anymore? I think everything's just MA now, right? It's just mature. I think we have a much more like realistic rating system
for the most part. That's a really good point that I did not consider.
Cause in the '80s, you know, they would use green blood. Remember with, check out our interview with David Wayner where he does a documentary In Search of Darkness on horror. And they talk about that. There's a reason there's like green and blue and like black blood in 80s horror movies, is because it would prevent them from getting that dreaded NC-17. When we talked about Star Trek, First Contact, check that episode out. We talked about Star Trek Undiscovered Country. The blood is more pink looking, because they learned it, if it was more red, they were teetering up on an R rating because of the realistic nature of the blood. So maybe that's a reason that.
Yeah, no, you're right. Because obviously it, like the script was already, even, you know, pre-production people were like, it's going to be too gory and too gruesome. So I could see them, with everything else they do in the film, having to like, you know, tone that down. That makes a lot of sense.
I wonder also if it might have been a stylistic choice by Demme, because it's more theatrical looking, that kind of red paintish looking blood. And Lecter is such a theatrical villain that I'm wondering if maybe that was just kind of, you know, the dreamlike stylistic choice he makes for that scene. But
that can make sense.
Okay. Here's what I want to look at. This movie spawned like a lot of stuff and books too. I mean, the books also were the inspiration behind it. But, and I didn't know this for the longest time, 5 years prior to Silence of the Lambs, we had Manhunter, which I just watched for the first time. It's a Michael Mann movie. He wrote and directed it. And it's the first time we actually get Hannibal Lecter on film, and it's portrayed by Brian Cox. It's called Manhunter, but what it is the first time Red Dragon had been filmed. So then you get Silence of the Lambs, and years later we get, I think the order goes Hannibal. I think we get Hannibal first, based off of the Thomas Harris book. Then you get Red Dragon, so you get a retread, essentially. Then you get Hannibal Rising, which is, I don't know if anybody else has even seen it. And now recently, in recent years, we've had Hannibal, the TV show, which is really a complete reimagining, dare I say, a more fantastical version of telling that. And then CBS, Paramount Plus, has just released Clarice, the TV show focused on Clarice. And what's interesting about Hannibal and Clarice, Hannibal, the TV show, is not allowed to mention Clarice Starling, and Clarice, the TV show, is not allowed to mention Hannibal Lecter due to who owns the rights to which character.
Oh my gosh.
That's some like Marvel DC stuff going on there. Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. Now, have you guys seen any of the follow-ups or Manhunter?
I have not.
Not one. Brandon hasn't seen one. What about you, Aaron? It's probably a good call, buddy.
I saw Red Dragon with my boyfriend in college, and that was
that Highlander?
My boyfriend or the movie?
I thought, was that your boyfriend Highlander, or is that just a dude you met?
No, that was just a dude I met. Yeah. Oh, my God. No, this boyfriend took me, the first movie date we ever went to go see, took me to go see the movie Blow. And that ended up, that's a podcast for a different day. Because I ended up playing out with drugs later. But no, I went to go see this movie with him, and it was like, oh yeah, it's Hannibal Lecter, blah, blah, blah. And it was too gory for me. Once they were doing the like back of the head thing, I was like, I can't do this. I'm out. It's too much. So that was it. I never saw anything else. You thought Manhunter was the one that you would recommend?
It's the honest to God of all of these, it's the only one I'd recommend.
Yeah, so I'll probably watch that.
And I would say I actually feel like it feels like these two are Silence is the superior movie, no question. It moves along much brisker. The characters really are better, but they really feel like a sequel pair. Like they feel like they exist together. Whereas Red Dragon, you know, is a little more into the campy, a little more over the top for me. It's not. The guy that plays Red Dragon, Tom Noonan in Manhunter, is very much like Hannibal, like Buffalo Bill in Silence, where he seems very grounded in reality. Like, oh, he's a large man and he's crazy and he's got this thing that he's okay, right? I will say it feels even more like a procedural than Silence of the Lambs does, which is why I think Silence is better. It kind of balances the different, I would say genres, right? It's kind of multiple genres within it. And the viewpoints that they show of Clarice and Hannibal, they don't get into some of that more technical stuff, but man, it is even more procedural and it really builds to what I think is a really, really good ending. So I would suggest checking that one because they feel like natural pairings. Red Dragon, Hannibal, too over the top, too campy. Hannibal Rising is terrible. it is bad. I couldn't even bring myself to attempt to rewatch that one. Let me say this, since Ryan had to leave us, he is a huge fan of the Hannibal TV show.
I know a lot of people who really like it.
Yeah, it's very popular. It's definitely a more fantastical version. You know, in John Wick, how like it's a world where they're like every person is potentially an assassin. Feel like in Hannibal the TV show, every person is potentially a serial killer. So it's a little, I don't know. I struggled with the first season. I love the second season. I struggled with half of the third season, and then the last half was pretty good. But Ryan is a big fan, so he would defend that. And then Clarice just came on. There's like 6 episodes, and it is a snoozer. It's really just a basic police procedural that they throw Clarice Starling in. Like, it's not – it doesn't have the feel or any of it. They're just like – just give your character a Southern accent and there's going to be a lot of sexism. So it's the follow-up to Silence of the Lambs. It's like your basic CBS procedural drama. So for me, check out, really seriously, I would strongly suggest checking out Manhunter. You got Michael Mann. So you got a very solid hand, you know, guy that did Heat, guy that did Last of the Mohicans. You got a steady hand there. So I would suggest checking out Manhunter. Screw the rest. Ryan would tell you to check out the TV show.
Yeah, I do know people who like that. I think there's something that turns me off to... This happened, and I ranted about this on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh yeah, with the Ratchet with that was on
Ratchet. Ratchet.
Because Nurse Ratchet is a terrifying villain because she's real. She's a real person. There doesn't have to be anything fantastical about her or over-exaggerated. In fact, I don't want her to be over-explained by being like, well, there's something supernatural about her. Like, no, she's just like an evil person that exists who thinks she's doing okay. Like, the humanity of her is what makes her so terrifying.
Right.
Her flaws. Hannibal Lecter is terrifying because he's a real person. The minute you start, I feel like, adding any sort of fantastical or supernatural elements, I feel like it loses some of the terror. That's just me.
Right. Yeah, well, and the show gets into what I would call like pseudo-psychology. Like, it's just like everyone's a head case and every... I was like, this is just too much. It's too much for me. And that's why I love Silence, because it feels so grounded. And that's why I liked Manhunter. It feels grounded. And nothing else that followed has. So, okay. Well, anything else to add? I think we've skinned this one.
So we kind of fought earlier. It's a shame that Ryan can't be on here because we've been arguing back and forth. This movie is touted by IMDb and by the Academy as a psychological thriller, but we're making the argument that it's a horror film. And it actually was, I have to find it, but it Metacritic 85 out of, or where was it? Metacritic out of its 104 film critics, the website's critical consensus reads, director Jonathan Demme's smart, taut thriller teeters on the edge between psychological study and all-out horror and benefits greatly from stellar performances. It's also recognized by Ebert. He later added the film to his list of great movies, recognizing the film as a horror masterpiece alongside such classics as Nosferatu, Psycho, and Halloween. So we know there's a lot of people who argue this. I think Ryan was going to have some good thoughts on it, on why he felt that it shouldn't just be categorically a horror film. He's the horror guy on Flashbacks, but I know Jay feels
he's one of the horror guys.
One of the horror guys. One of the horror guys. But Jay's our other horror guy, and he feels like this is a straight up horror. So can we talk about that just for a hot second?
I'm convinced, especially when it comes to prestige stuff, we couldn't possibly call it a horror and give it a best picture Oscar. Like that'd be like that's a bridge too far. Yeah. I mean, it's a psychological thriller. Give him the award. I think it's for me, it's just a thing that in cinema, horror just feels like this genre that doesn't get taken seriously, even though I would argue the last 5 years might completely change that with Get Out and Hereditary and The Witch and Midsommar. And there's a lot of, you know, it feels like the 70s kind of had that more prestige, serious type of horror, and then it just faded for a few decades, so it stopped being taken seriously.
Right.
Even though we love all that stuff from the 80s and 90s, and well, maybe not 2000s, but so to me, it's just like it's avoiding that genre because it's looked down upon.
Mm. Brandon, you have any thoughts?
Yeah. I think it walks the line. I mean, beautifully between, because I mentioned in our thread earlier and stuff, the game that Hannibal and Clarice play with each other is the psychological aspect of this. And then I think that of course, later on Hannibal, that takes a more horror turn as well. But I think it definitely walks the line between the two. And I think it almost had to in order for the Academy to recognize it. It couldn't have been just straight up, just blood and gore and jump scares and all of that. But I think it definitely falls between the two. And I think it's the first real, you know, classified horror movie that really got any kind of real respect. I mean, Psycho got some respect, but it didn't get nominated for Best Picture. And, you know, and most of Hitchcock's work, Hitchcock really didn't delve into horror much. I mean, Psycho and the Birds, basically the rest are all romantic thrillers, I would call them. But yeah, I think it really, it showed that the prestige critics could recognize something like that, unless your name was Gene Siskel. But I think it really does sort of meld the two worlds together and shows that, you know, we can make sort of an important art form out of the genre.
I think that's an interesting point, because I think a lot of the stuff we think as the more prestigious type of horror, it took time to make that assessment. You know, in our Shining review, we talked about how it had several Razzies it was nominated for. You know, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, The Exorcist. I think they were well received, but I think it took decades for people to be like, oh, this is really, this is some really effective film work, which is why these movies are effective. You know, I don't think they were necessarily recognized in their time
Right.
For being of a high caliber for the Academy type of, you know, I don't like using the term high caliber and all that stuff, but like right. Of like what the Academy might look for. Cause I would say those movies were in Get Out, you know, Get Out also kind of walks that line as well.
Yeah. So according to Wikipedia, so take this with a grain of salt, but it places Silence of the Lambs, the article that I was reading, places Silence of the Lambs in the category of, you know, it's the only Best Picture winner widely considered a horror film and one of only six horror films to have been nominated in the category, and that they include The Exorcist, Jaws. That one's for you, Ryan. The Sixth Sense.
Oh, that's true.
Oh. Yeah, Black Swan, which that's interesting. Now, that one, I feel like I'd argue more thriller versus horror.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And Get Out.
See, I jumped on the Black Swan one.
I forgot that. Right. Yeah, I forgot Exorcist had been nominated. And I don't – Jaws, I guess I would put Jaws more on the thriller aspect. I can see where it would be horror because Jaws. I mean, the shark's kind of like the Frankenstein monster in Dracula,
right?
But
I've always thought of it as an adventure
movie. Yeah, it's like an adventure movie
with a few scares in it. But I think at the time it came out, it was viewed a little differently.
I love how you say it's an adventure movie. That's like my husband when we watched Slumdog Millionaire, and he's like, it's a bunch of kids having a good time, and I'm like, that's what you saw? That's not what yeah, I get how people consider Jaws a horror movie in the sense of like, that's a real terrifying fear, and sometimes an irrational fear people have is the whole shark attack thing.
Well, every Midwesterner when they go in the ocean knows there's a shark right there.
Oh my god, that's so true.
All right. Well, we should probably wrap her up. So, Brandon, what do you got coming up?
Oh, man. Well, a week after I believe this drops, you will hear an episode that we just recorded with Aaron celebrating the 80th anniversary of Citizen Kane. And that's coming out. And we had a really, really great discussion on certain aspects of that movie. We'll be celebrating the 70th anniversary of An American in Paris with Patricia Ward Kelly. And then we're going to have a busy May, June, July. We're going to be talking everything from Hitchcock to sci-fi to slapstick comedy. We're going to have Larry on our show for the first time. He's going to talk the Pink Panther with us. And so there's a lot of fun stuff coming up.
Awesome. Aaron, what do we got? What do we got?
We have got the 35th anniversary of Stand By Me, just in time to get ready for summertime adventures. Also, make sure you go back and, like Jay already talked about, we released an amazing interview with documentarian David Wayner, who directed In Search of Darkness Parts 1 and 2. You can find those on Shudder right now, which you can purchase that subscription if you don't already have it, through Amazon Prime channels, I believe. He's also got a couple of other really great ones, In Search of, or The Last Action Hero. Is that what it is?
He produced In Search of the Last Action Hero. Okay. And he's working on In Search of Tomorrow, which is a sci-fi, 80s sci-fi documentary.
Yeah. So come on over to our feed and take a listen to those, especially if you love 80s horror.
Heck yeah. We also will be the Front Row Flashbacks crew taking over Full Disclosure. So we are going to do a double whammy with both the original and the new Mortal Kombat, which at the time of recording comes out tomorrow. And it's going to be bloody fun. And we're hopefully going to try to squeeze in an interview or two next month. But one, hopefully to highlight a veteran that operates in the pop culture sphere to coincide with Memorial Day. We also have in May coming up, The Rock for its 25th anniversary, which pretty excited for that one. Then Memorial Day special, we'll be taking a look at another Best Picture winner, Platoon. So we got some good stuff coming up, and hopefully everybody will check it out. So we appreciate everybody listening. Brandon, thank you for joining us on this adventure. Yeah. Ryan, absolutely. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ryan. We appreciate it.
You're ruthless.
He can't help it, folks. He's limited on his options. And Aaron, as always. So thanks for hanging out, guys. Thank you for listening to Front Row Flashbacks, and make sure to tell your friends to check us out. Our pod is on any number of podcast apps, so look us up and please subscribe. While you're at it, if you really dig what we do, please join us as a full-time patron. Our Patreon link is in the show notes, and we would love for you to give us your money. I mean, to be a part of the team.
And be sure to look up the Front Row Network for any of our other content, like Front Row Classics, with hosts Brandon Davis and Eric Flick. Hold on a minute. We've got a guy on this podcast with the last name Flick.
He legally changed it for the show because that's the dedication we bring people at the Front Row Network.
Well, that's amazing. And just as amazing as some of our other shows, such as Guilty Pleasures, hosted by Lou Hare, and our Beyond the Mouse crew that covers all things Disney and so much more.
In short, we have something for everyone at the Front Row Network. Make sure you find the Front Row Network on Facebook and subscribe to our main feed on Spotify or whatever you use to access your podcast. We can also be found on NPR Illinois' website under Community Voices, and you can follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. For the Front Row Flashbacks, this has been Ryan Lutens,
Jay Hoffman,
and Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you all in the front row.